Well, at a time when South Africa really doesn't know what's going on, or most people in South Africa, we've gone to our wise man. Dr. Frans Grenier is a political scientist, scenario planner, author. He also runs Frans Grenier Private Clients, which specializes in independent political and economic strategy and advice to his clients, who I'm sure are banging down his door at the moment. And here he is to give the BizNews tribe insights into what next. I say what next, Frans, and what I didn't mention, because I couldn't actually get an exact date. How long were you the CEO with the Institute for Race Relations?
Yeah, I was there for 18 years or so. I must have been CEO for 6 or 7 years.
But that's a wonderful pedigree, the Institute for Race Relations. I see that there is now a little bit of information being put into the public domain about it. It is, certainly it's the premier foundation in South Africa, independent foundation, and it's been fighting against abuse of power for almost a century now. And most people kind of get the view, given what happens in social media, that the IRR has suddenly become this right-wing racist organization, but it's actually the antithesis of that.
Yeah, well, I can't speak for it today, but the interesting thing about its positions is that they really never shifted since its establishment in the 1920s. And initially, the response to it is that it's a rabidly left-wing, a later front for communist aggression aimed at South Africa. And as the decade shifted, the perception becomes a radically right-wing front for right-wing aggression aimed at South Africa. But the basic principles that it advanced had never changed. So it was quite an interesting way of seeing how popular public opinion shifted over 100 years.
It is indeed, but it's also, I suppose, you can appreciate why, because those in power right now, and right now in South Africa, those in power are really fighting for their lives. There's no other way of viewing it. And by power, I mean legacy media on the one hand, which is promoting a ANC, which is not even defending some of the stuff that it's done in the past, but just saying, Donald Trump, don't interfere in our system. Now, I'd love to get your perception on this, because years ago, Nick Benedel, the man who started Gibbs and the dean there for many years, said that the ANC has actually just picked up the old apartheid party, the National Party's playbook. And in many, many ways, they've repeated what they've said. And in years gone by, I well recall the National Party saying to the rest of the world, do your damnedest. We reject any criticism or any interference in internal affairs. That's a long introduction, Frans, but really, let's get to the nub of all of this, of what's happening, and maybe you can help us through where South Africa is and where it's going to.
Okay, where do you want to start, Alex?
Well, why is America so important? Why is it so important to South Africa?
If South Africa wishes to survive as a unitary state, not to fragment and break up into enclaves, a kind of balkanization. Remember, it's a very young country, only really comes together 110 years ago or so. If it wishes to do that, and if it wishes to remain a member of the liberal democratic order, then it needs to vastly improve its economic performance to create the kind of society in which any child born into it can rightly aspire to a middle-class standard of living. And if it fails at that and continues to exclude vast numbers, particularly young people, from full participation in the economy. The opinion in South Africa will later radicalize, and the country will fragment, and it will fall out of the league of the liberal democratic order. And the United States is important to South Africa in the sense that the economic and diplomatic and cultural relationships across the Atlantic are essential to determining which direction Africa goes. If the tie with the U.S. is fundamentally broken, it will later also be broken with the rest of the Western liberal order, and South Africa will ultimately fail in key respects. If the tie is well established and excellent relations on all those three levels occur, then South Africa should ultimately succeed.
Well, that's quite a sobering analysis or perspective of where we're going. This balkanization of a country that, as you say, we often forget was only put together, tacked together in 1910. But why is this latest, what is being perceived by the ANC, assault on South Africa's sovereignty relevant in that context?
Well, it's relevant because if the relationship continues along the trajectory that it's now moving, what's going to happen is that the developmental relationship that our USAID will be gone, a goal will be cancelled, and there will be sanctions brought against South Africa. So that's why it's important now. We're not far from that point.
Wow. Okay, a goer I get, because Donald Trump can. I think that comes up for renewal later this year.
Don't worry too much about the dates. It's always possible to review it in the moment, but this year is correct, yes.
And then there is the review of the relationship with South Africa, which is at the U.S. House of Representatives, which was initiated even during the Biden administration. So you'd imagine the recent spat, that's not going to give us much support there, and given that the Republicans now control it. But sanctions, would they really go that far? And does that mean Kentucky Fried Chicken, McDonald's, Ford, IBM, Microsoft, Amazon would have to pull out?
I'm not sure what form it would take. But thinking in that direction would not be an exaggeration of what is now possible.
Franz, is what you're telling us potentially then a repeat of what we saw in 1985 when B.W. Botha stood up and wagged his finger at the Rubicon speech, and thereafter Willard C. Butcher of Chase Manhattan Bank stopped all loans to South Africa. We became a capital exporter. There was massive divestment from this company, this country. Interest rates went to 25%, etc. Are we at one of those moments?
We're at a similar moment. That's exactly the thing to remind people of. He wagged the finger. Chase Manhattan said, "We won't roll over the loans." And South Africa is essentially bankrupt. What's very different is at that moment, there was a second parallel process in place in order to help maintain the relationship. Much of that was the Sullivan Principles era. And what had happened in the background is Americans with foresight, drawing heavily on Chester Crocker, who was then the Assistant Secretary of State's constructive engagement policy, had been to see key South African leaders and had said to them, look, the American business community is going to break from many of the, certainly the petty apartheid prescriptions and regulations, and are going to begin treating South Africa as if it is already a reformed kind of a state. And in one of those engagements, the relevant minister also wagged his finger at the chap who'd gone to see him and said, "You do not think that you can push this country around. We won't tolerate this," similar to the contemporary response to the US. And in that meeting, the minister then asked his aide to leave the room and fetch the tea or something. And when the young aide had left, who was obviously there to supervise the minister, because you can never trust the minister, the minister said to the chap who can't see him on behalf of the Americans, "Listen," he said, "what you guys are doing is the most important thing that could happen in this country, and we support you completely to change. My government will have to attend. You know, we've got to keep our end up, you know, all that." It's still pretty early in the process. So there was a very important parallel process underway that sought to salvage the relationship and use American investment as a constructive input to help South Africa reform to a point where it would, after the moment of reform, ultimately become a liberal democratic state. One of the dangers in this moment is that those same parallel structures of the same foresight, ability, and sophistication are not in place, and therefore the relationship here can fracture.
So what implications has this right now got for the government of national unity? You can see the feedback is instantaneous nowadays from the public, and there's huge amounts of criticism of the Democratic Alliance, its leadership, and its approach, which seems to be exaggerated perhaps through the megaphone of social media. But what, looking at your scenario, what is likely to be the impact of where we go from here if our government hasn't got that back channel, we'll say one thing in public, but actually in private we think we do need to change?
Well, I think the first step is that there needs to be a better understanding of the issues here. I don't think broadly, my experience of talking to people, what you read in the South African media, that there's a proper understanding of the issues that are at stake. And if that doesn't change, then it's going to be very difficult to repair this relationship or indeed hold the GNU together and the implications of that. So that would be the first place to start. Perhaps we can go into that in a moment. Let me answer your question on the GNU itself. The Democratic Alliance did very well, and John Steenhuisen too, to put themselves in a position last year to join the government and avoid the then prospect of EFF and MK. We'll talk about them now too. And he put himself and he put his party and his party colleagues in an extremely powerful position where they could influence the trajectory of government policy. What was always going to happen in some respects or another is that either the DA was going to have a great influence over the ANC and press in a reformist direction, or the ANC was going to have a very great influence over the DA, press it in an ANC direction. What has come to pass is that the ANC has neutralized the DA. It has placed the DA in a position where the DA is implementing historical ANC policy positions, even where these run firmly against historical DA positions and even against cabinet promises that the DA contested last year's election. And if that continues to persist, there's Bella, for example, we could talk about that in detail. Why I said we must understand the issues is it's not understood why the Americans have taken the view they've taken. It's not understood what's actually at play in Bella. It's not understood what's actually at play in the expropriation legislation. We have also endorsed the ICJ process and in fact voted for funding to continue that, which is at the heart US gripes with the South African government. So the DA is in many respects neutralized. We're in the field at the moment to test the opinion. It's a bit early to do that now. We'll see the beginnings of it. But I'm fairly confident to say to you that if the DA trajectory continues as it is, they are going to suffer a catastrophic loss of support into the slightly longer term that will drive their numbers way below 12% and perhaps even beneath that. Money.
Sure. So there's lots for the DA Brains Trust to be considering. Do you get any feedback that they are awake to the threat? A little bit. It sounds a little bit like the Social Democratic Party in the UK, and after they got wiped out with their coalition with the Conservatives.
Yeah, I think there's some people that are concerned, but the requisite action to correct course, I don't think there's sufficient movement on that at this time. And let's just step back here. I want to think about the ANC. It had a very difficult time in the last year. It goes down to 40%, but shell shocked. Gets into this governing relationship. Towards the end of last year, we pulled the ANC back at 46% again. So it's 6 percentage points up from where it was, feeling a bit better about itself. If it looks at the environment around it, the first thing that it notices is that the DA has, in the ANC's view, has really become a doormat to govern. It's implementing older ANC positions with nine enthusiasm. One ANC chap said to me, is this it? Is this the DA that we were worried about? These guys aren't, chap's view. These guys are terrible. Just a being. Moletsi Mbeki has said recently that the tragedy of the GNU is that the DA's policy positions are not really no different to those of the ANC, which means there's no one in the government capable of driving the reforms necessary to ensure very much much higher levels of growth in the economy. So the ANC feels much better about its position versus the DA. And we found a wonderful partner. It's kind of like a wing of the ANC's credibility. It then looks to the EFF, where there are internal and personal problems that are disabling the ability of the EFF to be effective. And also last year, we saw the EFF was already weighed down relative to its election results. The ANC then looks the MK party, which will have a very difficult time in getting over the obstacle that so much of its vote arose from the perception of Zuma and Zuma's persecution. And if you're the ANC and you survey the world in this way, you can start to be confident that perhaps our party's back to a position where it can again contest for South African majority. So that's how the ANC, I think, at this time is perceiving the political environment in the country. And just back to the DA, when it contests the next election, I think some of its voters are going to be very confused about what to do now, because if the policies that it's advanced are indeed the offer to DA voters, some are going to begin to think, well, why don't you just vote for the source of this, for the ANC itself? So the ANC is our first sort of strategic point in this. The ANC is moving back into perhaps a much stronger position via the GNU than it was certainly than it was in the year ago.
Sure. So if the DA does not come out strongly in supporting its old policies, the policies that people voted it into office with in this fracas that we're seeing, because we've heard nothing from the DA. We've heard nothing from China, nothing from Russia, which is also interesting. Nothing from the other BRICS members. Unless it does that, are you saying that they, well, maybe the question is why? Why has the DA been so silent in all of this?
I don't know. Don't know what's gone on there. But let's perhaps get into one or two of these issues. Like something like Bella. It's perhaps the best way to start answering your question. Bella has a primary issue, nothing to do with Afrikaans. Bella is a piece of education policy that reverses a lot of the gains made in early post-94 education policy in South Africa. The South African Schools Act got passed in 1996. And what was very good about it is that it increased greatly the authority of parents to decide on the education of their children, what went on in schools, school governing bodies, that. The Bella legislation reverses a lot of that and gives those powers back to the state, and that's not a good thing because a lot of education research will show you that the more you allow parents into the schools that their children attend, the better outcomes are, for the simple fact that parents care more about their kids than bureaucrats do. Now you're in a position where the DA is implementing the Bella legislation. It's also made a horrible mistake in casting Bella as a question on Afrikaans. It turned up at the Voortrekker Monument, the DA, to pose Bella in a sea of orange and blue and white. Its campaign notes around Bella had the Taal Monument of 1970, whatever, in the background. And what the DA created in doing is to set up Soweto in 1976 again. The DA was fighting for Afrikaans education and the ANC was fighting for liberation. And that was a fight the DA could not possibly ever win. And so they lost on Bella and now they're implementing. The tragedy of it is that if you attend a school where teachers don't arrive on time or are drunk or sleep with the pupils, which amazingly happens, Bella will greatly reduce the prospect for your community, your parents, to take charge of that school and change that sort of thing. So the entire approach to Bella was so madly misguided and then leads to this loss on Bella when the core problem with the legislation, the core thing, Afrikaans is downstream of it. The core thing is parents will lose a lot of their authority to decide over how their children are educated. Downstream of that is language and downstream of that is Afrikaans. And that's all very important if you're an Afrikaans parent. But it's not the core issue, but the DA campaign with Afrikaans issue. If you go to the question of expropriation, okay, let's take that as an example, the new act, the question of null compensation is a red herring, and the question of land is also a red herring. You see media reports about the Land Reform Act. It's nothing of the sort. The new expropriation legislation will allow the state to seize any property, fixed or movable, for less than its market value. When you do that, you gravely weaken property. The previous act, if you were expropriated, compensated on the grounds of market value and for financial loss. So if you were one of my clients and came to me and said, we're going to invest in South Africa, what happens if we're expropriated? I'd say it's very easy. You get an accountant, and you'd get a valuer, and they would tell you what the value was of your investment, and the court would agree to that, you'd be compensated. then property rights are secure because market value is an objective measure to judge compensation gains. The new Act dilutes market value considerably and adds other subjective factors, such as the national interest, which could mean absolutely anything, to the calculation of compensation payable. So if a firm came into South Africa today and did its due diligence and said, what about expropriation? Someone in my position couldn't possibly tell what compensation they might receive if they were expropriated. So it's again maddening that the discussion that goes on about the Expropriation Act is centered chiefly on the question of land and chiefly on the question of law compensation, which are two arguments the ANC can relatively easily win on old sort of historical liberation grounds. And that the core problem, the heart of the Expropriation Act, is hardly understood across the country's economy. Now, let's take just those two pieces of legislation, Bella and the Expropriation Act, both being implemented in the DA. The consequence of Bella is in practice to put an end to any serious prospect that we will be able to improve at scale the quality of education outcomes in the country. And this is a country where 500 kids will pass maths and matric with a grade of 50% or higher. The Expropriation Act is in practice going to have the consequence that South Africa will never attract the fixed green fields kind of investment, that it needs to raise the rate of fixed capital formation to GDP. That's a good measure of the attractiveness of the country. And in a country like South Africa, fixed investment to GDP should sit at about 25%, 30% better. In practice today, it's sitting at 15%. And the press can argue, and sociology professors, national interests, but in the real world, where people really invest with real money and large amounts of it, the subjective nature, the calculation behind compensation in this act means that we will not raise the fixed investment number to 25%. Therefore, we will not raise the rate of economic growth from the current 1 to 2% to 4 to 5. Therefore, we will not. It's not a debate. We will not increase the rate of job creation to a point where we can erode the massive official rate of unemployment above 30%. The global average this year is 5%. If we do not do that, we will later radicalize Africa, and the risks of fragmentation and like they're all coming to play. And I would urge slightly to think that when the most powerful man in the world and the richest man in the world, both of them, on the same day, take 10 minutes out of their very busy agendas to say to South Africa, in practice, on property rights and on the question of taxing capital on arrival in the country through BEE, you will not be successful. It might be a good thing to hear them out. But by the evening that they had done that, South Africa, not en masse, but organized business, organized agriculture, much of the government, the ANC and the DA, had turned on them and said, you're talking nonsense. You don't know what you're talking about. We're not interested in hearing you out any further. And the people who responded in that manner to the American moves on South Africa did so, they must remember, from the context of an economy that is only growing at 1%, when its emerging market peers are growing at 4%, with an unemployment rate of over 30%, over 50% for young people, in a world where the global average rate of unemployment is under 5%. And to a very great extent, the reason we find ourselves facing economic indicators such as that. Part of that can be found in the response to the interest that Mr. Musk and Mr. Trump expressed in South Africa's future and in core policies of its government.
Franz, if we step back from this a little, the independent thinker who's watching this conversation or listening to this conversation is probably saying, yes, but they would do that because they're heavily invested in the status quo in South Africa. And so any change to the status quo in South Africa would affect organized business, organized agriculture, clearly the ANC as well. Or is that in what I'm trying to get at here? And I'd like you just to also consider what happened in Davos. You had Javier Milei making a speech that was very strongly applauded, where the real focus was, we stand for freedom, which is the defense of life, liberty, and private property. Life, liberty, and private property. The very next day, Cyril Ramaphosa signed into law an act which attacked private property. Now, he can't be that thick. He's got to have wanted to send a message in some way, in the same way as the support of Iran would have sent a very strong message. Is it because he really knows he's got a backstop that, or is it just ignorance?
I don't know. Politics is about power and forcing a balance of power. It has very little to do with finding common ground or building mutual respect and admiration, any of those things. For a very long time, American administration took a pretty soft line on not just on South Africa, but on other actors who, as actions might have been egregious, is the terminology used in Mr. Trump's executive order. And I think a point was reached where many in the South African government thought they had the measure of these Americans. They were weak and they were soft, and they would always give in and apologize and feel guilty. So I think it's quite a shocking thing to come across the firmness that's been expressed by this new administration. Inside the thinking of any revolutionary organization, the ANC is no different. In the ANC, it actually words it explicitly that if you meet with no resistance, you're obliged to pursue your revolutionary agenda. And not doing that is called right-wing opportunism. You're taking advantage of the lack of resistance to actually quietly cultivate your right-wing agenda. The sort of thing Thabo Mbeki was sometimes accused of, Washington consensus, etc. On the other side of the spectrum, if you meet with firm resistance, you are required to stop your revolutionary advance and step back. And not doing that is called left-wing adventurism. And this is as serious an infraction as right-wing opportunism. And the reason is that if you advance against a determined opponent, the consequences could be that you suffer damage and losses that place the entire revolutionary agenda in peril. So on the theory of it, which I think is a very good place to start, you advance on some of these issues when you sense that there is so little resistance. If you go back to my earlier comments about GNU, where the DA had placed itself in such a powerful position just 6 months ago, but it's subsequently been completely neutralized out by the ANC. If you see what I told you about the EFF's internal personal problems, MK not getting over the Zuma obstacle, ANC might rightly feel somewhat emboldened to pursue some of the policies that are data, even more so when it reads some of the official responses, organized business, organized agriculture, the DA again, to its criticism of the Americans. And I don't think any of them have thought deeply enough or read carefully enough into what the Americans are saying about South Africa, or what their objectives and so deeply are.
It appears to be a clear underestimation of what's coming from that side of the world, especially if you consider that the economy is 70 times South Africa's.
It's a misreading.
It's the same misreading as the misreading we see on Bella about Afrikaans, and that the expropriation is about no compensation and farms. These are downstream issues of the core problem. And the question with the Americans, I'd suggest, is the same. The comments about expropriation that downstream of something else. And even I had to have this pointed out to me properly, because I was, if you read, I'm going to read it to you. The White House executive order, blah, blah, blah. Section 1. It ends with this. South Africa has taken aggressive positions towards the United States and its allies, including accusing Israel, the ICJ, and then this line, and reinvigorating its relations with Iran to develop commercial, military, and nuclear arrangements. And I'm led to believe that that line is the egregious action and lies at the core of the American concern that South Africa's future trajectory. And the other stuff, while also important, is peripheral.
I suppose it's worth pointing out to people who've forgotten it that South Africa used to be a nuclear power and gave up its nuclear facilities. So presumably there are notebooks that can be dusted off and sent off to Tehran, in theory anyway. But when we go one step further, France, the future of the Afrikaner, why would Donald Trump have specifically said that he's going to offer refugee status to Afrikaners? And just to give you an update on that, our Linda von Tilburg spoke with Neil Diamond last night. He's with the South African Chamber of Commerce in the United States. And in the first 24 hours, they've had 17,000 people applying for this. 17,000. So there's a lot on social media which says, no, the Afrikaners will never leave South Africa. This immediate reaction does tend to belie that. But why would he have focused on the Afrikaners?
You've got to sometimes try and translate Trumpism into something else. The statement, as I understood, and I was aided in this by some other people too, was really to say that if you persist down this road of threatening, undermining property rights in your economy and taxing capital on arrival, which is the problem with the Musk now confronts, then we're simply going to lose the potential investment and the skills and the like that fit within your economy and might allow you to grow. And if that's the case for your top skilled people, we're going to pick them up. And it's not about Afrikaners. There's not going to be a cultural affinity test at the U.S. consulate where you put a single versus of Sari Maret to qualify for a visa. And in fact, there's nothing in what Mr. Trump has said that is not already occurring and has been in South Africa for more than two decades, which is that a significant number of the country's most skilled people are leaving for the rest of the world because they judge that that offers them a better environment in which they can be successful. The evacuation of South Africa's doctors and engineers and IT professionals and entrepreneurial spirit into Europe and parts of the Middle East and Australia and New Zealand and so on. Just don't for a moment think that Mr. Trump has introduced an issue here that previously wasn't the case. It has long been ongoing. And you will see, you will need to do as a refugee status. You will continue to see an evacuation of South Africa's most successful people, black, white, Afrikaners, non-Afrikaners. If the investment environment in the country is such where property rights are undermined, where the education system doesn't produce the skilled people to drive high rates of economic growth, and where you shouldn't even tax capital as it exits an economy. You can't tax capital when it arrives in the economy. And you, again, the point I made to you earlier, these critics of some of the American remarks on South Africa, who were so fervent in their criticism, almost seemed confident, must remember they're sending that criticism from an economy that is growing at a fraction of the rate of its emerging market peers, with horrific rates of unemployment. And you know, America is a successful society. Mr. Trump has been a successful person. Mr. Musk has been very successful. Shouldn't knee-jerk chase that advice out of the country and say it has no merit. We are going to go and see you in America and set the record straight. What record are you going to set straight in Washington? The record that your economy grows 1% and your people don't have jobs, and therefore you don't need to follow any of this advice. This is not a route to successful South.
Franz, I'd like to close off our conversation with the unintended and perhaps possible consequences, and just to share with you that a week ago I drove from Hermanus, where I live, to Plettenberg Bay, all along the garden route, and it was an eye-opener to see the mass development, which is due to semigration from other parts of the country along there, from Mossel Bay to Wilderness. Wilderness was a tiny little place that P.W. Huerta used to live at. Now it's just one big development, and you go through George Neisner, Plett. It's an exaggeration to say that it's one whole developed area, but it's not far from it. Mass development, which would suggest that there would be people sitting there saying they're excited about your opening statement of the balkanization of South Africa, the Cape Independence movement getting new momentum, and so on and so forth. So unpack that for us and other unintended or possible consequences of what we're seeing.
Well, when I talk about the balkanization and fragmentation, it's not something that will happen. It's something that is happening as a response to the environment. In the same way, when I talk to you about the consequences of removing an objective measure of compensation and thereby, in practice, undoing the property rights protections in the economy, it's not something that will happen. It's something that is already happening. In the sense, there's been so much criticism of Mr. Trump's comments, for example, the government is seizing or confiscating property. It's in many respects an accurate statement, because confiscation is not, it's the last step. The seizure of a property is the final step in a process of compensation. It doesn't of confiscation. Confiscation doesn't start with the seizure. Confiscating starts with the laws and the policies and the justifications that will lead to the seizure of a property. So these things I mentioned to you are not the things that I'm guessing could take place in the future South Africa. They're things that already are occurring.
And the balkanization, fragmentation, is already occurring. And you identify one of its epicenters, where South Africans who have the ability to do so opt out of formal South Africa and move into golf and lifestyle resorts in the States. Their money, what they have of it, it's very safely ensconced, or safe as it is, in the US dollar and offshore. And that trend will continue to accelerate if economic growth remains at its current levels and radical and the climate for radical populism in the country builds up. So you can just, you can't actually just look around you, and you can already see, you're not an analyst to point it out, you can already see what the consequences are of persisting with the policies that this gene, its key partners, are now collectively driving for the country. And it's a very great pity, Alec, you know, because the inflection point of that election result last year had the power that it afforded potentially reform-minded people been employed correctly, the outlook for South Africa today might be very different.
Franz, I had a really interesting conversation with Corne Mulder last week, in which he said, at this point where we are now, it's either make or break for the country. We could embrace the messages being sent to us and indeed catapult the country and catapult the economy and create masses of jobs, or we could slide into oblivion in the way that, well, certainly the on the surface, it appears as though we are heading. Do you think that he's got a point there? And perhaps just to close off with, which way, how are the odds favoring which way that we will go?
Well, I think he makes exactly the right point. You couldn't be more correct. I don't know where it goes from now on. But I'm not. I think the potential to use this pressure that South Africa is under to employ, in as far as it's possible, the support of US and others to drive reform in South Africa and the pressure that they've created is absolutely an opportunity that can be seized for ANC pragmatists to identify that they are simply going to replicate again the circumstances that brought about the first defeat at the rise of the radical populist movements defending warfare. And I think for the leadership of the DA to consider that it is driving its party in a direction where it's going to suffer catastrophic losses of support. If these three realizations happen at the same time and then be pulled together, then the reform prospects for South Africa would look a lot better, Alec.
Dr. Franz Grenier is the chairperson of the Social Research Foundation. In addition to all his other credentials, I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.